Don't mess with Texas or they'll sue you in the Supreme Court. What a week to debrief. First, Texas files a lawsuit against four states at the U.S. Supreme Court. Talk about your last-minute Hail Mary pass. Plus, Facebook is apparently a big company. The FTC and several states have sued Facebook for antitrust violations. We unpack all of these issues, plus look at the Housewives of Beverly Hills legal saga, all in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law podcast. I am Joel Oster.
And I am Mackenzie Smith.
Mackenzie, we have a lot to talk about this week. I mean, this week has been a gangbuster week when it comes to legal things in the news. And I guess let's just start off with Texas v. Pennsylvania. Just jump right into the deep end. This is the lawsuit that was filed by Texas against, I believe, four other states. And it was filed at the Supreme Court, and it has everyone abuzz. Mackenzie, what were your initial reactions when you saw that this case was filed?
Well, you know, I mean, it's kind of a parallel to what's going on in the NFL right now. Like, Texas is just, specifically the Dallas Cowboys, are just, like, really annoyed that no matter what, they're still worse than us and we're terrible. And I am happy to report that there is something going on in this country that's worse than the Philadelphia Eagles. It's President Trump's record in court.
Okay,
you
well.
Know? I mean, that's, like, being better than Texas is just kind of what we do here in Philly. So it's nothing new to me.
You are gloating there in Philadelphia. It's like, bring it on. We took your Cowboys down, and now we're going to take your Attorney General down as well. Just go ahead and bring it. I noticed you didn't challenge the Kansas City Chiefs to that, but hey, I'll just leave that for another day.
There's no point.
We are still on our path to the Super Bowl. It's always kind of fun to see everyone else talking about, oh, maybe we have a shot. Maybe we have a shot. No, none of you. You don't have a shot. Maybe some of you in the NFC have a shot to make it to the Super Bowl, but that's it. Of course, I'm just trash talking here. So let's just about, I like the idea of this is Texas, and their attorney general filed a lawsuit against these four other states. And now what the basis of the argument, let's dig into the actual merits of the argument. Cause I got to tell you, because now I'm going to guess you and I are going to disagree on the merits. See, I actually think there's something to this argument. Now I know no one else likes it. I do know that the Democratic response has been weeping and gnashing of teeth, right? They've had their sabers out rattling. They are pounding the table as loud as they can. Mackenzie, have you heard that old story? Like, when the facts are on your side, you pound the facts. When the law is on your side, you pound the law. When neither the facts nor the law are on your side, you pound the table. Have you heard that saying?
Not in so many words, but I think that's pretty accurate.
And I think that's what applies here. I think the media, the Democrats, are pounding the table because they don't want to actually address the real merits in this case. Now, I know, Mackenzie, you probably think I have gone off the deep end. Is that right? You think I'm just totally off my rocker here in Kansas City to suggest that there are any merits to this lawsuit?
Well, first of all, only three of the four defendant states in the lawsuit have Democrat attorneys general. You're not forgetting about Georgia, okay, which is run by right. Republicans, and the Georgia attorney general is a Republican. So I don't think this is necessarily even partisan at this point.
Georgia's not partisan, but you got to include them, because if you don't include enough states to change the outcome, then you would get kicked out right away. So I do think as a strategic matter, you had to include Georgia, because if Trump loses Georgia, then there's no point in even filing the lawsuit at all.
Well, and I would argue that there's no point in filing the lawsuit at all when the day after you filed it was the safe harbor deadline for states to certify their election results. So
That is true.
Don't you wish you were a constitutional law professor right now? I mean, this is like the perfect con law exam question. We have issues of justiciability, original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court, federalism, comedy. I mean, it just, and when I say comedy, I mean C-O-M-I-T-Y. But if you read
comedy,
the bill of complaint
yes.
in this case, it's actually C-O-M-E-D-Y, because I LOL'd when I read some of these ridiculous libelous allegations.
Hey, note to Brooke, our production person, our marketing person, put that in a quote. That is classic right there. You got to put that in a quote and in our marketing material because that was just golden. Mackenzie, you come up with the stuff on the spot. You're a genius.
I'm coming in hot this morning. But no, I mean, I think we want to talk about the merits. I don't know how you get past the justiciability issues in this case to even reach the merits and how... You know, Texas, it's just ironic to me that Texas is the state. I don't know who ordained Texas as a state to bring this lawsuit and whine and cry that what four other states did somehow affects them and affects their citizens, because they're all like,
we're going to talk about that.
Don't mess with Texas. Don't mess with Texas. But wait a minute. We get to mess with you and literally tell you how to run your state within your own boundaries. Like, that's constitutionally ordained, and it's a power that the states have. And who is Texas to come in at the 11th hour and try to tell other states from Georgia to Michigan, like, how to run their election? It's just ridiculous to me.
Okay, oh, I got to pause here. Brooke, production note number two, tab that as well. Why is Texas messing with everyone else? I tell you what, you are on fire, Mackenzie. These are just great lines you are delivering. You are dropping them. You are on fire today. But you know what? You say you wish we could be a constitutional law professor teaching all these great issues. Well, we are going to act like we are constitutional law professors today, and we're going to unpack these various issues. Let's start off with what you are. Well, let me just state that here is the basis of the claim, in case you listeners that maybe you missed what actually the basis of the claim is. But Texas is saying, Texas Attorney General is saying, look, under the U.S. Constitution, there is an electors clause, I believe it's Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, and it says there that the state invests the state with the power to appoint in such manner as the legislature, circle that, highlight that, underline it, legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. And so that is the essence of this complaint, is that, look, the governors in these states or some committees or other individuals, someone other than the legislature is changing the rules for how these elections should be handled. And these changes tended to vote or favor heavily one particular candidate. And so because of that, because it wasn't the legislature that changed the rules for the election, therefore they did not follow. It violated the Electors Clause there in the U.S. Constitution. Now, Mackenzie, I actually think that's an interesting issue. Well, what is your actual thought on the actual merits of that claim?
Well, if that were true, and look, I'm only speaking with any kind of secondhand knowledge about what's going on in Pennsylvania. I haven't read the briefs from the other states. I don't live in any of the other states, so right, I'm a very Pennsylvania-centric commentator at this point. But look, if that were factually accurate, like, maybe some actually aggrieved party may have a claim, but some, having the Texas Attorney General bring such a claim is like having someone from Mars come down and say, you know, I want to complain about this in the Supreme Court of the United States, acting like a trial court. Like, it just doesn't, it would be the Pennsylvania legislature that would even arguably have standing. That's right. Already been adjudicated. And by the by, though, it's none of those votes, those late received mail-in ballots, were counted. Like, why doesn't anyone get this through their head? Like, even if you truly believe those votes were, quote, quote, illegally cast, like, there's no harm. There's no damages. They weren't counted. Biden won even without them. So I just don't, like, who is Texas to come in and tell us what to do? I feel personally attacked.
Now, I will point out, and you mentioned a lot of very good issues I want to address, but most of those issues dealt with standing, which is a legal term that says, should you even be in court at all? Do you have some basis to be in court? Now, there are various rules at play that pertain to that issue of standing, and we're going to unpack that here in just a bit, but it includes, can the court even redress your problem? So let's say you did state a problem. Can the court even fix that? Or are you the one that actually is harmed? Or are you claiming harm on behalf of some third party, not in front of the court? Again, those are all issues that go to standing. All right. But That aside, standing does not deal with the merits. And so I think that if you read the media and you go through all of these, you go to CNN, you go to MSNBC, even Fox News, no one's talking about the merits. They're just simply going, I can't believe Texas had the audacity to file this lawsuit. They're not these other states or whatever. But they're dodging the merits. I think the merits, that is a compelling issue. If these states are changing their election procedures, or if governors are doing it, or if an election commission is doing it, someone else other than the legislature, if they're changing the rules and how the game is played, and those changes heavily favor one candidate over the other, at least that's an interesting question. Now, I do want to jump into what you just said about, look, this doesn't amount to a hill of beans because the number of votes at play here, they're not going to change the outcome of the election. Here's what I think they did in their complaint. They dodged that, right? They did not allege this. Would you agree with me that this case is not about specific instances of fraud? They're not trying to say, hey, look, there was fraud that impacted 1 million votes, and our client lost by 900,000 votes. So if you throw out those 1 million votes, then it's going to change the election. They didn't make that kind of argument. They just kind of generally alluded to fraud out there. But more importantly, they said this change of the procedures could allow for fraud, and we don't have enough time to check that out because of the unusual short time period. Now, I know I threw a lot at you there, McKenzie, but what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that is shady. I think it's shady to do that, and they know that they don't have any evidence of fraud or any evidence of substantial
wide-scale fraud,
yes, of course.
And I think you see that in all these statements, wide-scale, substantial.
Right.
They say, oh, there's evidence of fraud, just not on the scale needed to overturn the votes.
Well, you know, and words do matter. I mean, it's like how you hear these sound bites of, we want all the legal votes cast. Like, people do kind of mince words, and it does matter to be accurate. And I do, look, I get from your point of view, like, the media, the mainstream media or the failing liberal media or whatever you want to call it, it frustrates me too a lot of the time, because I feel like, you know, people who have nothing to hide, hide nothing. And so I don't know why the media, most of it, feels like it has to dodge the merits of this fight. Like, let's get into it, because I am very confident that the merits would result in the same result that we have now. And I think it would, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Like, let's get everybody on board to what the actual facts are. I mean, it's tough because there is no standing here. It's very clear. It's probably also moot. It's probably not a proper invocation of the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. It's also res judicata in a lot of these cases. Like, Judge Brand of the Eastern District already decided these issues with respect to Pennsylvania. It was appealed to the Third Circuit. It got denied. It was appealed to the Supreme Court. It got denied.
Right.
I mean, this has been through the ringer so many times already. So it is a little frustrating on my side. Like, you know, we've been over this, but at the same time, like, I get it. Let's talk about, if you guys want to talk about the merits, let's talk about the merits. And it does bother me. However, I think if you just assume that there's a non-frivolous factual basis for this lawsuit and just assume that it's justiciable in the Supreme Court, right? Like, what is the remedy that Texas is asking for here? And is that, I mean, it's very shocking. Like, essentially, they're asking the Supreme Court, like, Texas, a conservative state who has a problem with activist judges overturning, like, the state's power and the will of the people. They're asking 9 unelected lifetime tenure justices to overturn a presidential election and essentially appoint Trump as president again. I mean, that's crazy.
So here's what Now, here's what they're asking, and it's a very fascinating merits question. If you actually dig into the merits, which is, okay, if the Constitution says the legislature is the one who chooses the electors, and the legislature created a system to run the elections, and then some other group other than the legislature, whether it be a governor from the other party, whether it be people on an election commission from the who is controlled by the other party or whatever, and they pass rules that change the rules, and then they all heavily favor one candidate, is that a problem under the Constitution? I think that's a fascinating question. But now what you're going to then is remedy. Well, remedy then is what can this court offer? And oftentimes, if it's a political question, the court says, we can't answer political questions. And so we're just going to keep our hands off of it. But here's what I think they are asking for. They're not asking for the Supreme Court to declare that Trump is the winner. They're not going to do that. They're going to say, look, Supreme Court, we want you to declare that in those four states, the legislature has to appoint the electors, not this some other group other than the legislature. So send it back and make the legislature convene and appoint electors. And so the legislature could go ahead and appoint electors that would favor Biden. That's highly possible. In fact, I kind of thought that's what the legislatures did. I kind of thought at the end of the day, after the people voted, the legislature then said, okay, these are our slate of electors. We approve them. Send them on out. Turns out that's not what happens. The election commission usually then certifies the electors, and it never goes back to the legislature for one final vote. But I think that's what they're asking this court to do. Just send this back to the various state legislatures and have them choose who their electors should be. If they want to follow the vote of the people, as bad as that vote might have been, as bad as the rules might have been changed to allow for that vote, still, that's up to that state, and I think that's what they are asking. Any thoughts on that?
Well, their prayer for relief does ask the Supreme Court to enjoin the defendant states from using the 2020 election results for the office of president to appoint presidential electors to the Electoral College. So they're asking for the court to forbid these states from regarding the popular vote result. Like, that's wild.
Let's just stop right here. That's not going to happen, right? First of all, a lot of this is not going to happen. But now that we're in this world of the court actually entertaining this lawsuit, right, we kind of have traveled down this kind of Alice in Wonderland venture through the election code.
Alternative facts? Is that the word you're looking for?
Right. The court's not going to do that. The court, I think, might say, send it back to the legislature, and they can do whatever they want to do. Clearly, under federalism principles, the government cannot then dictate what the state legislatures do. They can do whatever the heck they want, because that's the election allows for that, or the Constitution allows for that. They want to base it upon the vote and ratify it after the fact. They can do that. That's the state legislature. They're not going to forbid. I don't think the court would ever grant them that kind of relief, but let's actually kind of back up here and talk about the court. You kind of alluded to it a little bit, that can you even file this in the Supreme Court? Well, interestingly enough, that is one of the bases that you can get original jurisdiction at the Supreme Court. If it's a dispute between states, then the court can pick up a case. Now, will the court pick this case up? I have no idea. The court has its own rules for when it decides to exercise original jurisdiction, so the Supreme Court doesn't have to pick this case up, but they very well might think that, wow, now that Trump has intervened, and now we have 17 states that are part of this, we can't just sit on the sidelines here. We got to say something. So I'm not sure they're going to stay on the sidelines here, but they definitely could deny that the request to take this case up. Any thoughts on if the court will even take this case up?
I think it's really, this lawsuit has really put them in a very difficult position. I think that, if you look at the list of cases cited in, and I've only looked at Pennsylvania's brief in opposition to the motion for leave to file a bill of complaint, there's the number of 2020 cases that are listed is out of control. There have been so many cases since November 4th, and they continue to come. And I think, it really does put the court in a difficult position, because the original jurisdiction clause, I guess, of Article 3 really, I mean, it doesn't limit itself to this, but historically it's been used to adjudicate things like, you know, if there's a territorial dispute or a water rights dispute between states, or, you know, one state is sending all its trash to another state, is a case I seem to remember, or something like that.
Right,
it's
right.
Not historically used to adjudicate political disputes between states. And I think, you know, it's kind of dangerous territory. And I'm just wondering, you know, Texas seems to, and this is just coming to me now, it's kind of stream of consciousness, but Texas has, I think, recently kind of tried to market itself. I know there are a lot of high profile companies and individuals that have kind of like left California and relocated
right.
to Texas. It's really lowered its taxes. It's trying to attract businesses and wealth. And I think Texas is kind of positioning itself as like this anti-leftist haven, which it's that's Texas's prerogative. I mean, look, if
right,
people
right.
want to go and live in the you know, realm of crappy football teams, like that's up to them. Great barbecue though. Great barbecue. But you know, I guess maybe you would dispute that being from Kansas City, but who knows?
Well, it's good barbecue, right?
I
mean, there's no such thing
in Texas.
As bad barbecue.
Yeah. You know, but I don't know. I like where to draw the line is like, you know, Texas can do whatever it wants in those regards, but there's got to be a line somewhere to where you can't start messing with what other states do within their borders. So, you know, I personally would love to see the Supreme Court issue a written opinion saying, you know, why this case is not justiciable and that, you know, we can't do this, but I don't know. I mean, I think it's dangerous territory here because if you allow this case, if you say that this is justiciable, at least, and say that it's, you know, a case that a state could bring, then isn't that opening the door every time a state doesn't like the result of an election to sue the other states and micromanage what other states are doing and kind of dip their hand in the pot there and, you know, not leave
right,
it
right.
to the state to control what it's doing in its own borders. And look, in Pennsylvania, there were disputes between the attorney general and the legislature after the primaries and all throughout the summer. And some of those went to court and some of them were political negotiations, but that's our business. Like, don't mess with
let's
Pennsylvania.
Talk about that.
I mean, I wish there was a word that rhymed with Pennsylvania, but you know,
Transylvania.
There's not,
no,
I can't come up with anything.
Well, let's talk about that. Cause we've been dancing around standing. Standing has a lot of different components to it, but one of them is injury in fact. In other words, you got to assert injury to yourself. That's why you are in court. You are seeking relief for an injury that you yourself have suffered. And generally speaking, you cannot bring claims on behalf of third parties. So Texas cannot say, hey, look, Pennsylvania messed it up. They violated their own procedures, didn't follow their own rules. That hurt the Pennsylvania residents. No, Texas can't do that. Texas has to say, this has harmed us. Well, so what is their harm? Well, this is their harm. Their harm that they claimed is that, look, this is going to impact who the vice president is. And the vice president cast the tie-breaking vote in the Senate. Texas has senators. This is going to impact their votes in the Senate. Now, is that attenuated? Yeah, sure. It is kind of a stretch, but does it show some level of harm that Texas suffers? It does. There is a little bit of harm there because the vice president does cast the tie-breaking vote. And I think that one of the responses from maybe it was Georgia that said, look, when Biden was the vice president, he never once cast a tie-breaking vote. So it very rarely happens. And it's not a real harm. Well, that's a weak argument. It is. Here's the point. It is an argument. So if the court wants to take it up, there's the avenue it can take it up. But this does dilute Texas's vote there in the Senate. But I will tell you, listeners, standing is one of those things. If the court does not want to hear a case, here's what they're going to say. You lack standing, go away. That's what they do. If they want to take a case up, voila, they're going to find injury. That's just how the Supreme Court operates if they want to take the case up. But McKenzie, this very well might be a case they don't want to touch, because I know this has just been filed. So I am processing this in real time. So I might say some things today that I contradict what I said on my update 2 days ago. But give me some room here for making mistakes on the fly.
It's all moving very fast. Yes.
Exactly. I had to analyze this like on the moment, on the spot. By the way, my updates that I do every single day, I kind of think I pegged this case. Now, we'll find out after the Supreme Court rules. I'm going to go back and I'm going to watch that update that I did on this case. It might get deleted if I totally botched it. That you will not be able to find it. But nonetheless, here's the point that I'm trying to make. The Supreme Court might want to say, look, we don't want to issue a ruling on this at all. I mean, no matter how we write this opinion, as you alluded to, McKenzie, this could open up the door for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide every single future federal election for here into perpetuity. So every 4 years, they're going to be flooded. Every single state is going to say, hey, their procedures violated our tie-breaking votes rights, whatever our rights were, that tie-breaking vote. That's going to open up Pandora's box for tons of lawsuits every single 4 years. I don't think the court's going to want to do that. And so the court's going to be very leery to even take this case at all. They're much more likely to say, no. So here's the other point. Now, you can comment on that if you want to, McKenzie, but I want to now kind of address latches. So some people are saying, look, there might be merits here. There might be standing. All very good issues. But guys, you brought this in the 11th hour. I mean, you should have brought this when those states made those changes, if that was a problem. But now that you've waited until, what, a day before the safe harbor provision and a week before the Electoral College meets, you know what? That's kind of late in the day. And so there is this principle called latches under the law that if you sit on your rights to the point where now you prejudice the other party and you prejudice the entire proceedings, then that's on you. And you should have brought this case earlier. What do you think about latches?
I love latches. I love all equitable defenses. I'm such a dork. But
you're so equitable.
Yeah. No, I think it's very interesting in this case because, as you pointed out, you know, these decisions and these changes were made before the election. And make no mistake, everyone, that if, oh no, my fire alarm's going off in my office right now.
All right.
Can you hear it? Hey,
yes, we got a fire going on in McKenzie's office.
I clearly have come in too hot this morning.
your takes were hot.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that is, Brooke, this is production note number 3. We have a fire alarm going on. So are you going to respond to that fire alarm? Or are you going to sit there and burn to death? I just got to know.
You know, the last time it happened, someone's hard drive was on fire.
So really?
Yes, and there was like this horrible toxic burning plastic smell in the entire building. So I'm probably going to go just make sure that I'm not going to burn alive. Is that okay? And then I can jump back on. I'll push this
exactly.
on pause.
You know what? We're going to put this on pause. And actually, you just keep it running. Just come back in. We'll be good.
All right. I'll keep it running. I'll be back in like a couple minutes.
All right, we are back on now after McKenzie took care of her fire alarm. I assume that your takes were so hot, it really started burning the place down. What happened? Or do you even know?
Look, it's not the first time. Won't be the last. No, I have no idea. Someone probably had a bagel at the toaster for too long. I don't know. Okay. I'm glad to know that someone's, you know, making sure that that doesn't happen and burn the entire building down. But
here's the deal though. I'm just curious what kind of person you are. This actually is based upon a true story. Let's say you're in a hotel and let's just pick a city, St. Louis. All right. You're on the 11th floor of this hotel and it's 3 a.m. The fire alarm goes off. What are you doing?
Oh, well, can I respond to this with an anecdote of my own?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I want to know.
When I worked at a big law firm in Center City, Philadelphia, I only worked, the building I worked in wasn't a skyscraper, but it was probably about like 20 stories. I worked on the 5th floor. And in 2011, you probably won't remember this because it was kind of an East Coast thing, but in 2011, there was an earthquake in Virginia.
Okay.
And I was sitting at my desk. It was like the middle of the day and I felt the room kind of shake. And I got up and I looked out my window down to the street below to see if there was a truck or, you know, something that would have created this sensation. And I didn't see anything. So I thought, huh, like maybe it was a you know, gas pipe underground. I didn't know. So I sat down for a second. I wasn't panicking at all. And I had been in a couple earthquakes before when I lived in Italy, nothing major. I mean, it wasn't like a California earthquake where you know what's happening. And then I thought, you know, that really was weird. I'm pretty sure the entire building was shaking. So I opened the door and went out into the middle of the hallway, which is where the, you know, administrative pool was, like all the cubicles. And everyone was kind of standing up and looking at each other like, what was that? What just happened? And I mean, okay, disclaimer, I was a new mother at the time, so I was a little panicky. So I'm still not panicking. And I'm saying, I said, what was that? And everyone was saying, I don't know. The building was shaking. So at this point, I opened the door to the stairwell, the fire escape. And there's people walking down, like evacuating the building. And then I panicked. And I swear to you, I was pushing people out of the way. Running down those stairs screaming, I have a child. I got out of that building so fast. You would not believe. I was stepping on people. I mean, I just didn't, like, the disregard for the sanctity of human life was palpable. It was embarrassing. I'm still ashamed of myself and how I behaved.
Wow.
Like, I am not a good person in an emergency. Like, if it's fight, flight or freeze, I just flew out of there.
Wow, that reminds me of George Costanza. Yeah. Right? That's a George Costanza moment. Did you see that Seinfeld episode George Costanza?
Yes, I am basically George Costanza.
So, if it's 3 a.m. In a hotel and you're on the 11th floor and the fire alarm goes off, are you just sitting there in your hotel room saying, oh, that's a prank. That's not real. I am not going to get out of bed at 3 a.m. and walk down 11 flights of stairs. Or are you going to just say, you know what? No, it's a fire at 3 a.m. I don't want to be one of those, you know, people that are burned to death on the 11th floor and everyone else wonders, why didn't the guy leave?
Yeah, no, I'm not burning to death. I am out of there. I'm grabbing my kids and I'm out.
All right. So what I did was, after mulling this over in my head, I did realize, you know what? Everyone who dies, they had this exact same thought. You know, they probably went through this the same issue in their mind. And so I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go ahead and just go. So I go to the stairs and you can see the people from the other rooms coming out, looking around, and they all start walking down the stairs. We get down 11 flights of stairs. And then we found out, oh, it was just a prank. So we had to turn right back around and walk right back up and then try to get some sleep.
See, you had a cognizable claim for damages there.
Exactly.
That is actual harm.
That is harm. All right. So that is...
See, we brought it around full circle.
We did. All right. So let's just take a little bit of time here to discuss... let's make our predictions. What do we think the Supreme Court is going to do with this case? Because they can go the entire gamut. I'm telling you, I don't have any real idea what they're going to do, but do you want to put yourself on the record as to guessing how the Supreme Court is going to handle this case?
I can't even guess. I do not think they're going to reach the merits. I do not think they're going to hold an evidentiary hearing and act as a trial court. I mean, just like one last thing on the merits here, I think people need to keep in mind that what the complaint is in this case is not that people were prevented from voting, right? It's that people mailed in ballots and the argument is they shouldn't have been allowed to do that for whatever reason, because it wasn't the legislature that told them they could or whatever. In order to prevail and prove harm in that situation, Texas would have to prove, I guess by a preponderance of the evidence, that a significant or dispositive number of people who voted via mail would not have otherwise voted at all.
Right.
Because if every person who voted by mail, if they hadn't been allowed to vote by mail, would have gone to the polls anyway and voted in person, then there's no difference. So there's no harm. So it's on the merits. It's a very tricky, you know, we talked about kind of the media dodging the merits, but I think in these filings, you see the plaintiffs actually kind of skirting that issue and not really coming to terms with the fact that this is not a provable, there's no way you could ever prove that element of the claim. And also, the plaintiffs allege in their bill of complaint in the Supreme Court that Joe Biden had a, and I quote, 1 in a quadrillion chance of winning the election, right, which I think will be very difficult to prove. They say they have expert testimony on that. I don't know how that can meet a Daubert analysis, right, and competent testimony, but you know, a lot of things would have to happen. So all that to say, I do not think the court is going to reach the merits. I think either, you know, I mean, it's Friday right now. The electors actually vote, I believe, on Monday. So if Monday comes and goes and we haven't heard anything, then I think at that point the likely outcome is, you know, this is moot.
Right.
And we're not going to reach it at all. But, you know, we still have 3 days. We'll see what happens. But I think we have some kind of justiciability decision, if anything, coming our way.
All right. That's all good. Yeah. The whole 1 in a quadrillion quote. That was in the Texas brief. That did remind me of Mark Twain, who said there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And so, yeah, that quote, you can just, I don't know how they came up with that number. I mean, I read the brief. I still have no idea how they came up with a 1 in a quadrillion that number. But, okay, here's my prediction. This is the 11th hour. And so the court, I think, would like to write an opinion saying, no, this is you don't have standing. We're not going to open up the doors of the federal judiciary to last second claims like this. That would just swamp. That would make the federal judiciary the arbiter of all future elections. They don't want to go down that road. So they might want to write a nice opinion slamming that door shut. But there's just no time to write that kind of thought out opinion. With the electors meeting on Monday, you're right. That they're just going to simply say dismissed, not granted, and then just kind of leave it at that. I don't think they have any other alternative at this late stage in the game. If they write some kind of opinion, it'll be on latches, I think. Like, look, you should have brought this a long time ago. Now, whether or not you have claims or you don't have claims, we don't know. You can't come in at the 11th hour asking us to stall the electors. That way they're not really giving in to either side. They're not making some kind of precedent for a future, because there's just not enough time to, you know, analyze the implications, secondary effects from whatever decision they might reach. So I think they're just simply going to base it upon latches and say, this is the 11th hour. We can't meet or decide this in a timely fashion. The Electoral College is going to meet on Monday. They're going to vote, and it's going to be a done issue by Monday evening. So, all right. Well, there you go. That is our prediction. Whether or not it comes true or not, I guess we'll just have to wait and see until Tuesday. And then if we're really off, I might delete this podcast. I don't know. All right, well, let's move on to the second big legal issue from this week, dealing with
Tom Girardi getting sued again.
Who's that?
Tom Girardi getting sued again during his divorce with the Real Housewife of Beverly Hills, Erica Jane.
I missed that.
There's multiple lawsuits now.
Really? Ooh. What's going on there?
Yeah. So apparently, this is not the case you wanted to talk about, but I'll just interject very briefly that the plot thickens in Beverly Hills. Tom Girardi has now been sued by Wells Fargo. Apparently, according to Wells Fargo, he has not been making payments on his lease for like office equipment or something in the amount of like upwards of $1 million.
Okay.
So I think you were right when last week you said this is all, you know, red flags that he's up the creek financially and something is not right. So, you know, I mean, they're all allegations. Nothing's been proven yet. So we want to, you know, reiterate that, of course, he is, you know, has not been, you know, found liable for anything at this point. But there's definitely a lot of smoke.
All right. So production note number 4 for Brooke. Mark, tag that. Mackenzie just said I was right. So let's just copy that and then use it whenever we want. But we definitely got that now marked and tagged. All right. No, I did tell you last week that, hey, look, if there's anything that comes up in this case, let me know. And so, yeah, apparently he's not doing well. He's being sued. Wow, you would have thought that he would have spent his money more wisely, but apparently those injections cost money. I don't know. They're in a world of hurt down there. Who knows what's going to happen? So, but they're still getting divorced. Is that right?
Correct. As far as I'm aware, that is still pending.
Well, we are going to leave it up to you to keep us up to date on what's going on with Beverly Hills Housewives 90210. I don't even know what it's called. All right. No, Facebook was sued last week. Did you catch that?
I did. I'm excited about that. That's not the right word to use. I'm fascinated by this.
Now, why are you fascinated by Facebook being sued? Now, I know you're not on Facebook.
I'm not. I'm not on any social media anymore except for LinkedIn. Okay. I was never like a big social media person, you know, not like a person who used it a lot to begin with. But when I saw The Social Dilemma and, you know, kind of read, I read a book called... I read a book called Irresistible, and I can't remember the name of the author, but it's essentially about technology addiction and how harmful it is to children. And then right after I read that book was when The Social Network came out. And I've always felt like social media was very detrimental to society. So that's why I was never a big social media person to begin with. But when I saw The Social Network in the wake of reading that book, I was like, I cannot be a part of this. And I understand, look, I don't judge anybody else. My husband owns a business and he uses social media for his business and I fully support him. And right. I understand that, you know, it's become so ubiquitous and pervasive that if you are a small local business, it's very difficult to adequately market yourself when all your competitors are usually using social media without it. Like it's kind of necessary. And maybe that's, you know, evidence in and of itself why this antitrust suit was kind of inevitable. Like well, it's become a way of life. So
let's unpack it because Facebook was sued by the FTC and various states. I think 40 states in all ended up joining this. But nonetheless, they're facing two different twin lawsuits saying they violated the antitrust laws. Now let's just unpack the antitrust laws really quickly here. But way back in 1890, Congress passed the first antitrust law called the Sherman Act. Again, 1890, so a long time ago. Here's the bottom line with it. We believe as a nation that free and unfettered competition in the marketplace, that should be the rule. We think that freedom of the marketplace, it helps drive prices down so that people don't inflate their prices too much. It allows for supply and demand to happen. It also allows for products to be better because if two companies are in competition, they're going to make their products better, right, and cheaper. It's just really good when you have a free trade. And meanwhile, when you have these big companies having side agreements on fixing prices and things like that, that's a problem in our economy, and so that's why you have antitrust laws. Well, the thought there is, so if you become a monopoly, so in other words, you dominate the marketplace, or if you have some kind of anti-competitive agreement with another business to, in any way, you have an anti-competitive agreement, it's going to be subject to the antitrust laws. So that's kind of the basis of the legal structure. And so the thought is that Facebook, what they did is they purchased Instagram for $1 billion in 2012, and then they purchased WhatsApp a few years later for $19 billion. Now, Mackenzie, when I heard this, I got to tell you, that shocked me. That floored me. I had never heard of WhatsApp. How in the world is WhatsApp worth 19 times what Instagram is worth? To me, that's topsy-turvy. Do you have a thought on that? Is WhatsApp really that big of a thing out there and I'm just missing it?
It is. It is. And I think, you know, the timing also plays into it. Instagram that was purchased in 2012, Instagram didn't really blow up until a couple of years after that. So, you know, now the valuations would probably be a little bit different. But I know from living abroad and working with people abroad that WhatsApp is huge globally. I mean, it's what, think about Europe, like people, you have to communicate across international boundaries all the time. And with national telecommunications carriers, it becomes very expensive to do that. You have to pay roaming fees and whatever. So WhatsApp allows you to do that. It's an internet-based text and voice service, and you can communicate with anyone in the world instantaneously for free on text and voice. So, you know, I know that in China it's huge, and it's really like a lot of people's primary communications service, like in the rest of the world. It's only us in America that we don't use it as much, but yeah, okay. It's huge internationally.
Okay. So it's a huge app. And so they purchased those. Now it's not, again, an antitrust violation to be a big successful company. That in and of itself, now you could grow conceivably to the point where you are a monopoly and that would be a problem, but it's not just simply an antitrust violation to be a big successful company. But if you make business decisions and agreements that are anti-competitive, such as buying up all your competitors and then squashing them, that's going to be a problem. You know, the whole Pac-Man approach to operating in the marketplace, not allowable. And so that's a real problem here. And now there are some serious consequences for violating the Antitrust Act. The federal government can shut you down. I mean, they can force you to sell off all of these assets. They can split you up if you're an old-timer. Think of Ma Bell and what happened there. So the consequences could be dire for Facebook. Facebook is seems to be defending itself on the principle of we are too big to fail. I'm not sure that's going to play out. I think the government actually would be excited to take down a company that is thinks they're too big to fail. Do you have a thought on how this case might be resolved or what's at stake for Facebook?
I mean, you know, and what's at stake for the rest of us, too? It's a really interesting situation because, like you mentioned, with past antitrust situations, you know, we've had telecommunications industry. I think there are still antitrust actions going on in the mainstream media companies. So that it does happen. But it's interesting in the context of Facebook because it's not only... is it a big corporation, but it's also a platform for individuals to exercise their rights, right? Like we
right.
all use it to communicate. So there are other nuances to this situation that really haven't been at play in antitrust situations before. And I think it's very interesting because when you say it's not okay to be a monopoly, well, what else do people use? You know, I mean, there's really
it's huge.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, they use Instagram. No, Facebook owns Instagram. They also own that. Twitter is so different. It's really kind of going away. Not going away, but it's not really the same thing as Facebook as far as a social networking site. MySpace, who uses MySpace? I don't even know if that even exists nowadays. And so it is huge. In fact, just let's think back at the last election with the whole Hunter Biden issue. That was problematic. I mean, I know a lot of people were like, whoa, this is dangerous. Facebook has become so big, they are controlling the outcome of this election by refusing to allow information about Hunter Biden's laptop go public. How can you control that? That is a very significant abuse of their position. And I remember thinking, what can be done about this? It's a private company. And so they can control their speech as much as they want. Maybe we should do a podcast one day just solely on that decision, but that was a significant decision that they made. Now it turns out just yesterday, I think Hunter Biden admitted that he's been under federal investigation for various tax issues. And so, that does speak to the issue of are they too big to fail? All right, what about this, Mackenzie? Do you think the timing of this lawsuit is significant? In other words, it's in between administrations. So Trump is leaving office. Let's just assume that. Biden's coming in. This lawsuit was filed in between. Does that say anything?
I mean, I'm sure it does. I don't know what, just off the top of my head. But, you know, I don't think, unless there's some kind of, you know, statute of limitations issue, which I can't imagine there would be here. I think the decision to file these claims has to be strategic in some way. But please enlighten me.
No, I don't know. I kind of think Mark Zuckerberg is, I think he is basically spitting in the face of the FTC. I think this is going to be a bipartisan move. One could say that busting up a big corporation, that's maybe more of a Democratic idea. At least some people seem to think that, you know, Republicans like big corporations. I don't really know why that's true.
Which is so weird because wasn't Teddy Roosevelt like the trust buster? I mean,
he was.
Yeah, it's just, and I know that was over 100 years ago, but it's just funny how things can change. And you do think, you know, you hear Republicans, I guess, or more conservative people say, well, it's a private company, should be able to do what they want to do. And, you know, they don't want to make a cake for a gay couple. They shouldn't be able to have to make a cake for a gay couple. And then all of a sudden, when it's like, you know, a big company, a private company making decisions about whether to their algorithm promotes information about Hunter Biden's laptop, then all of a sudden the tables have turned and it's like, you know, I think we should all get back to being a little bit more intellectually honest about what we believe. Because sometimes, you know, it's good to have principles, and the result of those principles playing out maybe isn't what you would prefer, but you at least get to stick to the principles. And I think there is, you know, there's a big difference between a tiny cake shop and Facebook, obviously. But I think, you know, there is a line, a boundary where, you know, a private company maybe isn't so private anymore, even though it is not a government actor. I know that there are Supreme Court cases that say like a shopping mall was a public square for First Amendment purposes.
Right.
So why is Facebook different? You know,
I think Facebook is really close to being subject to First Amendment restrictions. Just like you said, just like the laws regarding shopping centers became places of public gatherings and subject to certain First Amendment rules, even though that runs counter to what the First Amendment says. Right. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. And through the 14th Amendment, that's been incorporated to state actors, and a shopping mall is not. Facebook is clearly not a state actor, but still, they control a lot of free speech. They control the marketplace of speech. It is a monopoly in that sense. And so maybe it is going to be broken up, and it might be a bipartisan effort, because I think that Facebook poses a serious threat when it comes to free speech, how much they control the marketplace, the fact that they are outside of the strictures of the First Amendment as we know it to normally operate, and now they're squashing all of their competitors. And so it's going to be a problem, and I think it's going to be bipartisan. Now, I've heard from some people, no, it's going to go away quickly. And I don't know. You know what? That's why we are around, McKenzie. We're going to follow this, and we're going to keep people updated as the case progresses. All right. Any final thoughts on this crazy week of law?
It really has been a crazy week. I mean, I don't even know. I feel very unmoored. Like, things are moving very quickly. We're in a lame duck session, hopefully, right now. It just seems like things are really moving very quickly, but you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. And oh, there's one final case that we talked about a couple months ago, the Tanzin versus Tanvir case with the individuals who were put on the no-fly list and whether they were able to sue FBI agents for money damages for being on the no-fly list for years. And I just would like to point out that we were right, and the court, I think it's a unanimous ruling.
8-0,
that they
yes.
can bring suits for money damages in this situation. So kudos to us, and kudos to the court for issuing a unanimous decision in these highly divisive times. I'm very pleased.
Thank you for pointing out how brilliant we are, because we really are brilliant. Our predictions are right on the money. We are now 17-0, and I just made that up, but all right.
Well, no, that's Kansas City in a couple weeks.
That's right.
I live in Philadelphia. We'll never be 17-0, please.
No, that's right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week, and so until next week, have a great week there, and try to stay out of buildings that are burning down.
Thank you. Will do.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess, Sean Wynn, and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do, Brooke Boland for spreading the good word about us, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.